You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
From Shakespeare to Schwartz, from Fosse to Alvin Ailey, from Sondheim to Bareilles, from McNally to Fay, it happened to the greats, it still happens every day. When lightning strikes, it's the moment you know. When lightning strikes, where you're meant to go. You can stand and shout Eureka, do whatever you like. You'll never forget the moment when lightning strikes.
Hello and welcome to When Lightning Strikes, where we talk about when your proverbial light bulb goes off, the heavens open, the seas part, the wondrous, heart-thumping, tingly, glorious mic drop moment when you discovered you had to be an artist. My guest today is Jonathan Mark Sherman. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm going to give some backstory on you, which great. I think is so cool. So at 18, you wrote a play called Women in Wallace. You submitted it to the Young Playwrights Festival, and James Lapine directed a reading of it. It went on to be done at the festival, directed by Don Scardillo, another legend. It was picked up by PBS TV's American Playhouse. I mean, at this point, you're a teenager with a cast that included Josh Hamilton, Deborah Monk, Cynthia Nixon. You've been writing ever since. You're a playwright, you're a screenwriter, you're an actor, and most recently, fast forward, you wrote the book for Bob and Carol, Ted and Alice, music and lyrics by Duncan Sheik, for the new group, and here we are now. And most recently, you did these gorgeous pieces of play, The Conversationalist, for 24-Hour Plays, Viral Monologues, and also wrote the musical for 24-Hour Plays, Fear of Frying. So welcome.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And how are you handling this moment in right now? How are you dealing with?
Oh, I'm counting my blessings as you know, or reminding myself that I should be counting my blessings when I'm not counting my blessings. Trying to stay healthy and safe and semi-sane. I've set the bar far lower than sane these days. And, just feel incredibly grateful that I'm with my wife and our two kids, and we are very, very lucky in this time of great chaos to have one another. And I've been, able to reflect, as so many people have been able to reflect, on what live theater has been, will be, is during this period of time, and how we can remain connected when we can't be around one another. I think I'm doing okay.
How do you stay creatively nourished and just sane, period? How are you keeping?
A lot of it has been actually those two short pieces. The 24-hour plays sort of pulled me in and said, would you write a monologue for one actor who's a pal of yours, and then another actor who's a pal of yours, and then would you and Amy Mann and Jonathan Colton write a musical for two other actors who happen to also be pals of ours? And and so those have helped, being able to sort of create these smaller dramatic works that get shared online. But some of the focus on my desk shifted the same way it shifted on so many people's desks so we're going to put a pause on all of the things that were either scheduled for early next season or, you know, until where there's so much uncertainty around live theater right now. There's a sort of an increased focus on, oh, okay, well, what is this smaller film idea or series idea that we've been working on? Like that's sort of moved a little closer to the front burner because while production on so many things has not begun again, how people are watching or will be able to watch those works of dramatic art, that we've seen in abundance during this period of time, as we all have watched more Netflix than we never knew, you know, ever knew was possible. So yeah, it's been a real, I mean, it's been I wouldn't have wished it. I don't wish it on anybody, but it certainly has its fascinations.
It's a good way to put it, fascinations. Yeah. Well, I geek out on all the offerings, you know, from Richard Nelson's Apple Play to, yeah, and all these, it's extraordinary, all these different ways people are launching their creativity, which brings me to your lightning moment. What was your lightning strikes moment?
Well, it's funny. I was thinking, you know, about that very question. Mine goes way back, even, you know, before the Young Playwrights Festival, because that was a little bit of a culmination of several years' work between my lightning strikes moment and that that first play that I wrote getting done. My lightning strike moment, to get to my lightning strike moment, basically came in the sixth grade, I was born and raised in New Jersey, and Livingston, New Jersey was my hometown, is my hometown. And I had the great good fortune. I lost my mother. My mother died when she was, when I was in the second grade, just starting second grade. I was six and she was 32. I have an older brother. Thank you. It is, but my older brother, who's eight, and my dad, who was eight at the time, I should say, and my dad and myself sort of banded together. And, you know, I thought, you know, when you're dealt a sort of a traumatic event like that, that young, you know, it's sort of your worldview darkens pretty considerably. And mine certainly did. And, but then I got lucky in that my father went in for a, I always liked movies and I always liked sort of theater in a sort of more abstract way, and music and various arts. But my father went in for a parent-teacher conference, and my sixth grade teacher told him that I had a flair for the dramatic and he should maybe explore, see if I wanted to take like acting classes for kids or something. And my father, who worked at Bell Laboratories at the time, asked a guy at work, you know, first asked me if that would be something that would be interesting to me. And I said, sure. And he asked a guy at work who was into Gilbert and Sullivan if he knew of any kind of anything like that. You know, this is all pre-internet. You know, you couldn't just Google like, you know, acting classes for kids. And my father's a trained electrical engineer and a brilliant, wonderful, amazing. He's my hero. He remains my hero. But he, this guy said, oh, well, you know, they have Saturday morning classes at a place called the American Academy of Dramatic Arts in the city and for kids, where you can do theater games and so, you know, and so maybe call them up. My dad did. And we would drive into the city every Saturday, and I would take these classes, which were revelatory, because they were very different from the classes I was taking in the sixth grade. Then after class, we would always go to see a matinee of a generally a Broadway show. We saw a few off-Broadway shows, but mostly a Broadway show. And when I say I was lucky, I really, looking back on it, besides the great luck of having a father who, you know, didn't hear that from my sixth grade teacher and say, oh, that's, you know, you think my son has a flair for the dramatic, I'll, you know, I'm going to continue on with my day. He took him seriously and tried to foster that, if that was the case. And I wanted, to pursue it, but the year I was in sixth grade was also the year that, and the only year that you could see, the two shows were playing on Broadway at the same time that year. One was called Sweeney Todd and one was called Evita. And, both directed by the late, great Hal Prince, who ended up becoming a mentor, friend, you know, huge person in my life. I miss him every day. One, of course, written by Stephen Sondheim, music and lyrics by Stephen Sondheim, book by Hugh Wheeler. While the theater classes were impactful, this time alone in a dark, large space with my dad, watching, as the lights go out and watching, it was at the time, it was the top ticket price was $20 for each of those shows for a great orchestra seat. So we ended up going to see, I particularly love Sweeney Todd. So we went to see that around 9 times, and we went to see Evita around 5 times. I think sitting in the dark, and I look back and I think, well, I don't think I could have fully understood or processed what was going on in those shows. They're very mature and nuanced shows. But what did seem to get through is that, you know, here in both of these shows, you have these extremely flawed, dark, complex leading characters who are getting laughs, getting, you know, songs in spotlights. They get to wear kind of funky clothes. I was aware that this was a job, so that, you know, people, you could get paid for doing this. I particularly remember a few of the darker Sweeney Todd lyrics. When those would get laughs, I sort of felt like, oh, the way I'm viewing the world as a kind of a dark place, it's okay to laugh at that. Sometimes it's okay to find humor in that. In fact, finding humor in that is one incredible way of dealing with trauma. And if you can then convert that into art, you can actually help people, as well as entertain, you know, hopefully make them laugh, make them, you know, enjoy this song, that moment. There's a lot of morality and intellectual, curiosity that was also sparked by these two shows, but seeing them again and again and again. But I thought that whatever this world is, I want to be a part of this. I want in on this. And remember very, very clearly starting to figure out, how can I get in on this? I tend to make very short answers, very long.
It's beautifully vivid. It's so fascinating to me because both of those pieces, as beautiful and profound and complex as they are, there's a lot of pain, both of them. And you were, not to psychoanalyze you, you were dealing with a lot of your own pain, I imagine.
Oh, absolutely, 100%. You
know, not to presuppose what you were going through. But, what was it about, can you specifically pinpoint what it was about each piece that was just so mesmerizing, transforming? And, oh, and I need to know, what who was in the cast? Was it Patti LuPone? Was it Angela Lansbury or George Hearn or George? Anyway,
I saw Angela Lansbury. I saw Len Carey. I saw George Hearn. I saw Dorothy Loudon. I saw in terms of Sweeney Todd. You know, I saw Victor Garber. I look back on it and I really. Again, you know, I use the word lucky a lot. And that's, you know, it really amazes me that I, and a thing I have said, is, you know, since I had the great good fortune of then both meeting and befriending Stephen Sondheim, because he started the Young Playwrights Festival. Yes. And so, had many chances then throughout the subsequent years to tell both Steve and Hal that, you know, thank you guys for giving me my life. And also you could have told me that, like, I wasn't going to see a show that good for several decades, that they weren't all going to be that good, that I was really, you know,
sitting the bar.
Yeah. Getting a rather legendary show that was also pitched sort of perfectly to what I needed emotionally. You know, there's a, I mean, there, I think, the idea, you know, I was also a kid who was starting to, you know, wonder. I came from a hometown where, you know, football was prized sort of above, you know, skinny little kids like myself. And so was, you know, just starting to wonder, wonder if any girls will ever take an interest in me, because I don't see myself playing football anytime ever. And so the idea that, first of all, these were, they're both in their, you know, they're both these dark pieces, but they're both also these very, you know, there's a lot of sex, you know, sexual tension in both of the shows. And so even, you know, there was, I think, the idea that I was seeing something that was maybe a little bit older than kids in my age were seeing, was exciting to me. When you say, did I see Patti LuPone? I only realized, sort of, took me a while to for it to dawn on me, oh my gosh, I think I saw, you know, even though I saw the show five times, I think we only went to see it at night once. And so I saw Patti do Evita, but I saw her do it once because she didn't do Saturday matinees.
Right.
So I saw, you know, and I have my signed program. You know, I was that kid who, you know, my dad would buy me the program, or, you know, I'd take that and the playbill, and, you know, and it's a mark of sort of what a different time it was. He would often say, cause I was like, I'm not leaving until everyone comes out, and, you know, I can sign, you know, and he would just go, okay, I'm going to go across the way to that coffee shop and I'll, you know, grab a cup of coffee and, you know, or I can keep sort of, he could keep an eye on me, but it wasn't, he's, you know, he's like, get all the autographs and then come over there and meet me there. And I would do that. And so I have these, you know, programs and playbills, that, you know, some of which were signed by people who 3 years later, 3.5 years later, I got my equity card doing, I played the Artful Dodger in Oliver, because for a tiny window of time, I was able to sing as a child. And two of the cast members were, you know, had been in Sweeney Todd on Broadway. It was Maggie Task and Calvin Remsburg in Pittsburgh. And you know, I was able to go back and say, you signed my program, you know, and now we're in the same show. Like that, you know, I don't know that I can ever be sort of more starstruck than I was at that, at those moments.
Was Oliver your professional acting debut?
It was. It's, I got my equity card. I was 14 years old. I was the Pittsburgh Civic Light Opera. Billy Porter, who is now a friend, actually auditioned for it as well. And so as I often say to him, whenever I see him, Billy, we auditioned for one musical against one another in our lives and they cast me. That's insane.
That's wild.
He was a local hire, no less. He would have been, but I think he was younger.
That's quite a role. So you were cast as the Artful Dodger.
Yes.
Your professional debut.
That was it.
And you sang, as you say. Gosh,
I did indeed. I got "Consider Yourself" and "I'll Do Anything." Were the, you know, my. Or I'd do anything. Gosh, it's been so long. I'm probably forgetting the song's title. But yeah, it was. But you know, and again, it wasn't just Maggie and Calvin from Sweeney Todd, but like Jamin Bartlett played Nancy, and she had originated the song "Miller's Son" from Little Night Music, and Clive Revel was Fagin, and he had. You know, he had been the original Broadway Fagin 20 years before that. So, you know, I mean, it was a very heady, heady thing for a 14-year-old.
And how did Hal Prince come into your life? It's so fascinating to me because I talked to Lonnie Price and he loves to share about how Hal Prince was a mentor to him. And I think it's so incredible how he nurtured people.
He certainly did.
In a genuine way.
I met Hal around the Young Playwrights Festival, but I really that friendship deepened. You know, that's because of my I went to Stage Door Manor summer camp for 4 summers. And one of my dearest friends in the world, I call him a foxhole friend, my friend Sandy Chaplin, Alexander Chaplin, from Stage Door, he actually came, I started in 82 with what we call our 82 crew, but he came a few summers after that. But I had met Daisy Prince, Hal's daughter, because she was in a show with a friend of mine from summer camp, and then a future girlfriend of mine was also in that show, but I didn't know it at the time, the way these things work. But then she ended up being cast in a show directed by her father, playing across from someone else who got cast in that show, who's my friend Sandy from summer camp. And they fell in love and they got married and I was a groomsman in their wedding. And, you know, so so basically I became, you know, they, when they like you, they like you. And they are, you know, one of the warmest, most giving families I have ever known. And they have become, you know, the that term chosen family, you know, they are unquestionably all part of my chosen family. So I really got a theater education that is, you know, that I have to pinch myself, still to this day. You know, I'm a 51-year-old man, and I still, when I think about the people I've been privileged to know, work with, be friends with, collaborate with over the years, it exceeds any expectations that kid in the audience for Evita and Sweeney Todd had.
How wonderful. And I love the full circleness of this. I didn't say that at the very beginning that, isn't it true that Women and Wallace star Josh Hamilton, and he was just in your gorgeous 24-hour viral monologue that you wrote.
I think I tend, and it may come from, you know, early parental loss, but it's, I tend to hold my friends close to me. And so Josh, for instance, you know, Josh was a groomsman in my wedding, and he, you know, is one of my nearest and dearest as well, as was Sandy, you know, and it's, while we met, you know, it's funny to think that this, you know, these two teenagers meeting at an audition at Playwrights Horizons for the Young Playwrights Festival in 1988, you know, both of our first babies were born, you know, our same doctor, 5 days apart, same hospital. it's one of those things where you just, you know, I feel really, really lucky to get to get to be on the same ride with a lot of people I really love, not only as human beings, but I love working with them as well.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
I read that your father bought you a typewriter, and that also helped set in motion your...
We can't quite figure out if it was when I was 12 or when I was 13, but it was one of those ages. He got me a type. You know, I basically was starting to. I was sort of a precocious and probably pretty annoying kid who was saying, you know, oh, what are these scripts? I could write a better script than that. You know, as a 12 or 13 year old. And so he went to Sears and he got me an electric typewriter with that you put a cartridge in for the ink. And he said, here, go, you know, knock yourself out. If you can write better, you know, look, that it'll even look like, you know, real type. And I think he may have had moments where he regretted that purchase, because there were, you know, as he likes to tell it, his bedroom and my bedroom at the, in the house I grew up in, shared a wall. And he said it sounded like it was raining in my room every night, because I never stopped typing on it. It was such an extraordinary outlet. I think I went from, the sort of progression was that I went from going, oh, wait, if I act, I can actually play parts where the person has a mother, or I can play parts where I'm not the kid who, you know, I can be different from myself, and or I can be very similar to myself, depending on how, you know, how I'm cast. And that when writing came into it, I sort of thought, oh, wait a second, I can decide what story is being told, not just be one of the people telling it. And I can, you know, and I spent all of my earliest writing efforts were just these little sketches where they were like wish fulfillments, where I'd say, you know, it was a character who looked suspiciously like myself, and another character who was the girl from summer camp who I had a terrible crush on, you know, but it goes better in the play than it went in real life. And I, you know, said funnier things in the play than I, you know, was able to come up with in real life, you know. And slowly the plays got longer, and I also started realizing, oh, you know, what's more interesting is, what if I don't say something funnier in the play? What if not every character has to be a thinly veiled version of myself? And this whole other world of imagination opened up to me. And I mean, I was, you know, hooked is a mild word for what I was.
But at that point, you didn't have, I know you were trailing at the American Academy, right? But you didn't have formal training at that point as a playwright. You just started writing, and
yep,
was there a book in terms of structure and all and act breaks? And
there were a few that were around that I sort of remember, but not the most sort of important books were published plays. Like I spent an enormous amount of time in the old drama bookshop. And it used to be on, before it was even on 40th Street, it was on 7th Avenue.
Yes. And upstairs, right?
Upstairs. And and they would, you know, you could go in there, spend hours and hours and hours, which hours. I did. I would sort of pick out like 30 plays and just sit, you know, find myself a nice little corner and start like sort of reading them, you know, and if it sort of lost my interest, I'd put it down and pick up something else. And then I always left with a handful of plays because, my dad had a rule that I have carried on, raising our children, which is, you could, you know, as long as you read them, you could never take out too many library books or buy too many books in a bookstore. And so I, you know, saw how plays were formatted and structured, from reading them and from seeing them, you know, and, I actually went, you know, I started submitting plays to the Young Playwrights Festival, mostly because that Young Playwrights Festival no longer exists, but there are now many, many Young Playwrights Festivals sort of all over the world. But at the time, what was incredibly attractive to me about the Young Playwrights Festival was that no matter what you submitted, you would get a written critique back. And I thought, you know, to have someone who doesn't know me comment on my short play is invaluable. because if I show it to my friends, they say, oh, that's neat. Oh, is that character supposed to be me? Oh, is that, you know, if I show it to my dad, I love it. You know, it's, and I wanted sort of as more objective criticism. And I submitted to them for 4 years. And I think it was the third year of those 4 years, where they said, we want to do a stage reading of this play. And that was a one-act play called Serendipity and Serenity. And then the next year was the year I was, it was the last year I was going to be eligible, because it was for writers 18 and under. And so I submitted, I sort of finished and submitted with the nudging of the late great artistic director of the festival, a woman named Nancy Quinn, who was wonderful. And she'd remind me every once in a while that, you know, if you finish it next year, we, you know, submit it somewhere else. And because you're going to be too old. We don't do plays by, you know, written by 19-year-olds. And so I finished the play, and that play was, they did a reading of it, and then they did a production of it. And that was Women in Wallace. And that started, I mean, I joined the Dramatist Guild. I got an agent. I got, you know,
not just of, LA agent, Sam Cohn, right? Yeah. Not just LA agent. Okay.
One of my great, you know, claims I can make is that I, you know, was actually at a table at the Russian Tea Room with Sam Cohn and saw him eat paper, which he was famous for doing. And I think, you know, by the time I was hanging out with him, it, you know, he was like, okay, I'll do the paper thing so he can tell everyone he saw it. You know, but it was more that. But yes, indeed. I mean, you know, I was, it's crazy to think back on that moment.
Do you remember when you were told that they were going to do Women in Wallace and that James Lapine would be directing?
Oh,
that you were in? Yeah.
I remember better than I remember, you know, more vividly than I remember some things that happened last week. I particularly remember it because it was, he was committed to doing directing a Shakespeare play. I believe it was Winter's Tale. I'm not positive. I'd have to look back for the public. So that was going to conflict with the dates of the Young Playwrights Festival. So they asked me, they said, listen, you know, James Lapine, we think would be a really good fit to direct your reading. But if the play gets chosen for production, he actually wouldn't be able to do the production. So if that's, you know, if you don't want to get sort of have your reading directed by someone who can't direct the production, whether he wants to or not, if we choose it, then we should probably pick somebody else. And I was huge fan already of Table Settings and 12 Dreams and Sunday in the Park with George. And in fact, that was, the Tony nominations for Into the Woods came out, sort of right around the time of that reading. So I remember, you know, congratulating him sort of sheepishly on the nominations. And he's like, oh, yeah, thanks. You know, but it was like the work's more important than that. And, but I sort of, you know, again, some of these things I look back on and I go, how did I know to say that? But I said, you know what? I don't care that he can't do the show if the show gets picked. a day spent in a rehearsal room with James Lapine, I'm going to learn a lot from that. And I did. And it was, and Josh actually didn't read Wallace in that reading. It was Robert Sean Leonard. Who again is a dear friend to this day. But one of the things I remember so distinctly about it is that I tend to underline a lot in my for rhythm in my scripts in dialogue, and I remember one of the actors asking in rehearsal, these are suggestions, right? But like, we can ignore these if we want to, or use them if we want to. And I was completely ready to say, oh, yeah, cross them all out, I'm just so happy to be in the room. And before I could say that, James said, I think Jonathan has really underlined specific words for a reason, and looks to me like the underlines are in the right place. So let's try to honor all of them, shall we? And it was like, 18-year-old me going like, what he said. That's what I agree. Honor all of them, but it was... it was a great gift for an established artist like himself. He gave me a confidence I did not have. I wouldn't have been able to say that in that room. And so he said it for me and made me realize that I could say it in the future for myself. It was an extraordinary, extraordinary, pinch me experience.
So many. I mean, can you share some of the guidance you've received from some of these people, or great writing guidance that was given to you, or guidance about creativity? Because you've learned from such extraordinary mentors.
One of the most straightforward that I never forget, first of all, because he wrote it down, is after the festival in this wonderful letter, because I sort of tried to play it cool during the festival, and then when it was done, as a sort of wrote a thank you letter to Steve, and he wrote me back this just gorgeous letter, but the piece of advice in it that is front and center in my mind to this day, as he said, I heard through the grapevine, which usually has it wrong, but you've been receiving many offers, and only do what you want to do when you want to do it. And he said, I know that may sound easy, but it's not, which is why I'm putting it down in writing. And sure enough, when I have strayed from that seemingly simple bit of advice, you sort of shake your fists up at the sky and go, he wrote it down. I was a teenager still. It's like, remember, it's not hard to remember. But again, it's one of those things of giving, which I think is so beautiful when artists consider it a part of their job to also be teachers and to give back and to make sure that the next generation of artists is getting taken care of. That was a thing, where maybe I would have felt more pressure to do things I didn't want to do, but I had this letter from Stephen Sondheim, who wrote Sweeney Todd, which changed my life, in my drawer, telling me it was okay to only do what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it. And that gave me, you know, gave me more confidence than I would have had without it.
What a mantra to live by.
Yes.
Yeah. When you think about it, it's making me think of that song, Franklin Shepherding. Oh. From Merrily. Love that song.
Christ. One of my there are stage door friends who can attest that we used to put on the album and I could lip sync it and do all the moves. that was sort of my jam, that particular song. So there's so many life lessons in that show, you know, and I mean, speaking of Into the Woods, I think there's more great parenting advice in that show than any parenting books.
It's true. And where do your characters come from? What's your process? Do you marinate? Do you write an outline first? Do you sit down and it flows? What's your process? Unless it's top secret.
No. It's far from top secret. It's just annoyingly, it changes constantly. It's the moment I think, oh, great, that's worked twice, you know, it doesn't work a third time. So it's sort of like in terms of where characters or ideas or images or themes come from, I'll sort of take them wherever I can get them. Generally it's, there's been an image or a sentence or, a sentence being said seemingly by a certain kind of character that stays in my mind for longer than other fragments are staying in my mind. And so I start writing down little bits and pieces. I mean, I always, to this day, you know, have... I have my smartphone in my pocket like everybody else, but I have my old-fashioned Moleskine notebooks and I always have a red pen and a black pen and write down little scraps of, you know, oh, that's an interesting phrase. That's an interesting image. That's an interesting idea. And as you know, I've tried to rush the process, and that never seems to work with me. That seems to work wonderfully with some writers, and I wish I could rush mine. It doesn't. I've tried. It doesn't work. The results aren't pretty. And I think it's just I only seem to write what I want to. I only seem to write what I want to write when I want to write it, and that has always had me with something on my desk from when my dad got me that typewriter till today. So. So it has worked out, but in terms of a process, I mean, it's the hardest thing oftentimes is just getting yourself to sit down in the chair and say, look at the, you know, what used to be the blank piece of paper, what is now the sort of blinking screen. And just, you know, you just have to start writing, and hope that, you know, a few months down the line, you say, oh, this is starting to resemble something that might make sense to people who are not me.
And you're a dad now.
Yeah, right? Indeed. So our son is 13 and our daughter is 10. So we are parents of a teen and a tween, as they like to remind us now. I love bringing them to sets. I think one of the biggest smiles I ever saw on Santa Loquasto's face was where I was acting in the Chekhov play Ivanov at Classic Stage Company. And Our son came in on a lunch break and he looked around the set and Santo was off for lunch. And I said, you know, what do you think of the set, son? He said, you know, he was the little kid at the time. He goes, great. I said, oh, do you, well, he's, the designer's not here now. Should I tell him that when he gets back? And he goes, yeah, tell him I thought he said he did a really good job. This is a great set. And, and I said, okay, I'll pass that along. I said, Santo. He said, and he said, I have a compliment for you from, you know, from my son who's 4 and a half at the time, you know, and he said, saying, he said, what? I said, it's, yeah, Sam came in the lunch break with Alexandra, my extraordinary wife, and said, you know, to make sure to tell you that your set's really great. And he's, face sort of just lit up, you know, because you said, I guess it's rare you get compliments on your Chekhovian sets from 4 and a half year olds, especially when the play is Ivanov. It's not even one of the funnier ones.
He's very intuitive, your son.
He is indeed.
And do you like to put yourself in your plays? Because you're an actor as well. Do you like to cast?
I've done it really once. I used to do sort of the first readings of a lot of them, but the only time it really seemed, because I always seemed to know people who I said, well, I could play that part, but so and so can play it a lot with a lot more skill than I can. But I wrote a play called Sophistry that was done in 1993 that had four parts in it for college age guys. And I sort of, there was one that we were just having a tricky time casting. And Nicky Martin, who was my college professor at Bennington and who directed four of my plays in their original productions and who I, you know, was a great mentor, great friend. I miss him all the time. But he had directed me as an actor in college plays at Bennington. So the idea of me acting in the play wasn't at all strange or scary to him. And it was sort of like, oh, you know, we have playing the other three parts, you know, there's a part already for Ethan Hawke. There's a part already for Steve Zahn. There's a part already for Anthony Rapp. I guess I will play this fourth part. but if it had been a play with only one college age part, I easily would have cast any of those three wonderful guys I just named over myself in a heartbeat. That one just sort of fit like a glove and I'm very happy I did it. But I'm not always itching to do that again. It's been such a pleasure gabbing.
It's such a pleasure and really, truly inspiring when I think about how your career trajectory and this carpe diem spirit. And there's so much about healing in writing. When I think about the pieces that you did and continue to do to honor your mother. And I just think that's so beautiful.
Oh, thank you so much for saying that. That's lovely. I like to think so.
Yeah, you're welcome. Well, it's great to talk to you and have a wonderful weekend.
The same to you. Every day when lightning strikes,
it's the moment you know. The theme song was written by Tom McGovern. This episode was edited by Kyle Moore, and the talent was booked by Anna Stroud.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical, Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Suffs has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.